fundamentally my goals in talking to you about sort of a legal perspective on how to best protect yourself as an entity contracting in the space of information technology work, and a little bit of the flip side if you are a contractor who is contracting out his or her services in this area. My goal is to help you to think of your lawyers as tools. And sometimes lawyers can be tools in a different sense, but we're not going to use that definition. We're going to use the helpful instrument definition of tools here. So to use them as both a sword and a shield, and to view your contracts in that way, to both help you affirmatively protect your intellectual property assets and to protect yourself against liability because of your possession of third-party data that you are under an obligation, whether it's contractual or an obligation of due care, which is something that I'll discuss a little bit, whether you're contractually or otherwise required to exercise care in the way that you handle that data. So, the sources of legal protection for proprietary information are basically threefold: contract law, trade secret law, and federal intellectual property and computer intrusion law. And by using each of these and all of them together, ultimately you can institute sound proprietary information security practices in order to help your entities garner a strategic advantage and to protect yourself against, for example, a competitor that may be looking to capitalize on a weakness in your protection plan. Yes? No, actually, federal and state law apply both. State level trade secret law is where your trade secret statutes come from. Federal law provides one source of intellectual property protection. There are state level intellectual property statutes, absolutely, another great source of protection. In general, lawyers will tend to advise toward the federal level because by doing a filing on the federal level, you have sort of blanket protection. And also simultaneously with regard to your domain names, by doing a federal level filing, you get a stronger basis on which to defend your domain name rights. But domain names are something that you immediately need to run a check and, you know, in the Whois lookup on Network Solutions page or whoever else you want to find. But great question, and please feel free to interrupt at any time during my talk because the goal is to, of course, address your questions and to have this be useful to you in your particular lines of work. The second part of my talk will address the multiple possible sources of privacy and security obligations and specifically tailor the obligations to the types of information that entities collect or have access to. And I'll be focusing on U.S. law, but bringing in a little bit of the foreign law that triggers obligations of care with information collected from clients and users. The benefits of leveraging law and agreements to protect information. As I mentioned, preserving competitive advantage and simultaneously limiting possible liability that arises out of breaches. And so these are the three sources that I've gone through. And I'm going to take each one in turn and explain how they can be used. Contract. On the most fundamental level, a contract is an agreement that sets forth the terms of the exchange that's going to happen between the parties that are contracting for the particular service or good. So, in the technology industries, we have lots of services agreements, development agreements, hosting agreements, consulting, maintenance. All of them potentially address access to confidential levels, confidential data in large quantities. And so, therefore, we need to consider each of the sources of breach points. Employment agreements and confidentiality agreements are the other two agreements that are implicated in a holistic plan for information management. Okay. Here are sort of the top 10 points that services agreements should contemplate, and this will permit you, hopefully, to be able to better leverage your counsel and to force them to really think through the ways that your entity might be exposed in the case of a breach. What sometimes happens, I've seen with my clients, is that the business people, and particularly the tech guys, will and women focus on the service level agreements. You know, what's the uptime, what's the downtime, what's our benchmark, what do we want the graphical user interface to look like? And they don't really think about, and their lawyers don't think about, how the service level agreement interacts with the rest of the agreement. Why is that important? Because the legal mumbo-jumbo that is part of the first part of the agreement, that's not the service level agreement, can potentially completely circumvent and eliminate the value of the service level agreement. All you need is one little phrase in the first part of the agreement that says, oh, and by the way, anything else that's in this agreement is trumped by this provision here. So you could end up with a situation where you think you have this wonderful agreement with great standards for the joint venture or the developed piece of property, and you end up with a problem. Okay, so these agreements generally set forth the relationship of the parties. What are the services that are being provided? Are they being provided in the context of a joint venture? Is it a contracting situation? Are all rights going to be assigned? Is it going to be purely a one-shot deal, or is it an iterated relationship where people are going to keep dealing with each other on a regular basis? Are the services going to be ongoing? Is this a very short period agreement? And the way that you're going to approach it strategically, how hard you're going to fight, and the kind of obligations you want to impose on the people are going to vary based on the relationship of the parties. Is this a known actor? Is this someone with a great reputation in the industry? Or is this, you know, upstart, garage-based enterprise, which may be a great enterprise, but nevertheless, they don't exactly have a proven track record, so you want to think about that in the way that you're protecting yourself contractually. Yes? That's an excellent question. The question was, what is the sort of basic contractual way, what's the phrasing, the language that's used in order to protect a release of confidential information in the context of a relationship? And I'm going to be discussing this a little bit in greater detail when I talk about confidentiality agreements. In general, what you want to do is you want to define what is the confidential information that's being released as precisely as possible, but also leave yourself an out for anything else that's released in the context of the exchange. Here are the games that lawyers play. I'll give you the sort of inside scoop. If you're writing the agreement trying to protect your own confidential information, you try to protect the world, and you try to write it in a way that you protect any release of information, intentional, unintentional, they hear about it from an employee's friend, you try to protect the world. If you're on the other side, you try to limit the definition of what constitutes the confidential information down to a written item marked as confidential, which has been directly conveyed to you in, handed to you via passenger pigeon. You try to limit it as narrowly as you possibly can to limit your obligations with regard to confidential information. So that's one of the games that you can play. But I'll talk about confidentiality obligations a little later in the way that one can try. The second point that generally is contained in the services agreement is a description of the product and the services that are being provided. And specifically, this would include issues like encryption and the standards that you want your providers to use. In particular, you may want to specify, and this will tie into point 10, the issue of assignment. Is there a particular individual you want working on this project? Are you entering into this relationship premised on a particular contemplated team of individuals who are going to be building your site or developing your software? If there are particular people that you need because of their expertise, you want to make sure that they're spelled out in your contract and named, and potentially their ability to assign their obligations under the contract are limited, because you don't want the garage startup to then end up as your primary service provider. Next, confidentiality. As we were just discussing, critical part of any services agreement. Restrictions on use of the proprietary information, restrictions on sharing the information, restrictions potentially on future work in the same area. Do you want your providers to also be working for competitors? Do you want to limit that ability? A non-competition provision, a non-solicitation provision, can limit your provider's ability to then go out and work for your worst competitor and then ostensibly solicit your employees away from you. Next, recourse for breach and survival of certain obligations. probably the key thing with confidentiality is to make sure that no matter what happens in the relationship, whether it goes swimmingly well and continues, or if all hell breaks loose and the provider breaches within the first 2 months of the exchange. In any instance, the harm of information release may have already happened, especially if it's a one-time transfer of information. So the critical, perhaps the most critical component of protecting information is to make sure that confidentiality obligations survive the cancellation termination of the agreement. So you specifically say, you are bound by the confidentiality provisions in this agreement from today until eternity or 5 years from now, whatever you're comfortable with. Whenever you think the information is obsolete, or if it's never obsolete, then you protect it on a permanent basis. So a contract is not just setting up what's going on in the moment, but it can be used to set up what's going to happen 5 years from now, 10 years from now, even after you're no longer working together as business partners. That's an excellent question. The question was, what happens if during the course of the relationship you discover that your provider has breached the agreement and is doing something unethical, potentially illegal? Say, for example, you realize that your provider has used one of your office computers to launch a denial of service attack or something like that. What happens? If you disclose this, you're going to be in breach of your agreement. The answer is, if your agreement is drafted a certain way, there's a standard exemption we carve out that if you have knowledge of any illegal act or if certain things happen, then the agreement is automatically terminated and you have rights of recourse. For example, your agreement will generally have an indemnification provision that'll say, if you do bad things while you're carrying out our agreement, then we get to come after you for money for any amount that you damage us, plus usually, and this can be critical, plus any costs and attorney's fees that we incur going after you to make ourselves whole as a result of the damage that you've done to our enterprise in the context of this relationship. So in any instance, that would be a very messy situation, but it's one that if you have a strong agreement in place that really thinks through the relationship in its entirety and everything that can go wrong, which is kind of not fun because you want this relationship to work, you want it to be positive, you want to keep working together forever, but unfortunately stuff does go wrong, and that's one instance that if you have a strong agreement you can get out of relatively unscathed in the long term because you'll get your money back. Okay. One little anecdote from my own practical experience. There was a situation, I had a client that was multinational advertising agency that was building websites for other multinationals. And this was their biggest client. They were all excited to build a site for them. It was going to be an online store. And one such termination event that I insisted on having in the contract was if the site didn't launch by a certain day. And everyone thought I was nuts because they'd just gotten these great new servers. Everything was going to be great. Turns out, for whatever reason, there was server failure. And it didn't launch. So in retrospect, that gave my client the leverage to decide, okay, do we still want to continue with these people? Do we still want to continue in this relationship? And can we afford to keep waiting and risk angering our own client that we are the intermediary for? So things like specifying launch dates can be a very potent force in terminating a relationship that's going south. Consideration, point five. What is going to be exchanged? Are there fees? Is the fee a lump sum fee? Is the fee going to be contingent on the activities of the site? And how that's going to be structured? And who will bear the cost of costs that are associated with developing the particular piece of intellectual property or maintaining it? Who's hosting it, if it's a website? And who will, on an ongoing basis, be responsible for expending capital to keep the relationship for the services operational? Things add up. For example, with contractors, are you covering costs of gas driving to and from the facility? Are you covering incidental expenses, parts that are required to fix a server? All of those things should be contemplated so that at the end of the day, if you get this enormous bill for all these incidentals, you don't need to fight about it. You just turn in your agreement and continue on your merry way. Next point, point six, intellectual property representations and warranties of ownership. Critical, critical component. If you're having something developed for you, you need to make sure that you, at the end of the day, end up with all of the rights in it. If you want to permit the developer to have some remaining rights in it, for example, the ability to use it in a limited sense while you are still the owner, a license back, which is what that scenario would be, fine, but you need to specify that. Unless your contract contains certain magic language, you don't own the rights to whatever the property is that's been developed. Specifically, that magic language is an assignment of inventions, and work for hire language is good too, but it's the critical language is really the assignment of inventions, in which the person that creates the particular piece of intellectual property says, I hereby transfer all of my rights in all media from now until the end of time to you. And I cut off all of my remaining rights in this property. And that's the critical language. Unless that's in there, you're going to have a battle on your hands later on, potentially. And the other point of this, and this sort of ties in with my point nine, is that sometimes in the course of developing one piece of intellectual property, you develop another one, for example. I had actually the same client that I mentioned previously, was developing a website for a different client of theirs. They used a third-party developer who registered several domain names as additional sites that are incorporated in the way that they designed the site. The relationship went south. The agreement was very bare bones. And one of the things it didn't contain was a provision that specified that all new registered domain names must be registered in the name of the person that commissioned the development, my client. So my client was stuck in a position with a provider they didn't want to work with anymore, holding domain names hostage for their most important client. They were over a barrel. They ended up re-signing with that particular company and then getting the domain names transferred back. But a little provision in an agreement that could have made the situation end up very differently. So things to think about preemptively. The other thing that's very important with regard to intellectual property, particularly where there's a risk of high liability if the work isn't original. Frequently in a contract, you'll see one indemnification provision saying, okay, if you commit bad acts in the course of your working with us, you're going to pay us up to a certain level of money, or if your acts are really, really bad or grossly negligent or worse. With the case of intellectual property representations, when they say this is original work, we promise you, there's frequently a separate section that says, if this isn't original work, you will pay us an unlimited amount of money. You are standing behind your work, no questions asked. And if a third party comes after us to say, hey, you're using, you know, my one line of code, or if, say, they decided to use a piece of code that was under a license agreement that prohibited its sale for a commercial purpose, same thing. You suddenly find yourself in a very messy situation, and the person that gave you the tainted code should be required to indemnify you against costs that you incur in that process. Ultimately, you're running the risk of it being someone's proprietary information without a real license agreement. You're never quite sure where it came from or whose it is. Right. I mean, honestly, my advice to a client in that situation would be go find someone who has a product that works well enough, that's not expensive to license, and work with it from there. There are lots of great tools that help in website building now. Some of them are not even that expensive anymore. So that would be what I would urge a client to do, is that not exactly in a website context, but a different context. I had a client very recently call me and say, so we had this company in here and they were looking at our servers and they mentioned that we're infringing on their intellectual property. What is that? And I said, okay, where did you get the servers? Oh, it was this nice guy in Thailand. He had this warehouse. Okay, and your purchase agreement said what? Purchase agreement? No, we don't have it. Bottom line is they were, you know, stolen servers, whatever they were. And someone else came in, saw that server sitting there, clearly someone else's intellectual property with the user and software running it. And my client was in a lot of trouble as a consequence of trying to save a few bucks on the server. So spending a little more on the front end to make sure that all of your intellectual property is completely legitimately licensed will save enormous, enormous lawyer fees later on. So preemptive planning would be what I would suggest in an instance, and err on the side of caution with licensing software. Yeah, absolutely. And this is sort of leading into our discussion of liability, which is what we've been talking about. The ways that you can get in trouble and how you're going to handle that within the context of your relationship if something does go wrong. Is there a limitation on liability that you will impose on your contractor and that you will have imposed on you? Say something happens to the contractor in the course of performing services for you on your premises. Are you going to be liable to them for the electrical cord that they tripped over when they were trying to walk to your server to work on it? Things like that. Next, data controlling use, probably the most critical, if not one of the most critical components of agreements. And there's a very important recent case that I'm going to talk about a little bit because I'm not sure that everyone's aware of it yet, and it really is changing the face of the way, the gravity to which, or it should change the face, the way that lawyers approach their contracting practices and data control provisions. Specifically, data control provisions need to specify the terms of user data mining, if that's an option for the particular provider, how that provider is going to store the information, if they get to use it, if they are required to destroy it at the end of the relationship, whether they can share it with anyone, and most importantly, that they certify that they will conduct all of their practices in a way that comports with the statements that you make to the world about the way that you control, collect, and use user data. The case that's becoming quite well known on this point, it's called PharmaTrack, and it was decided by the First Circuit Court of Appeals on May 9th of this year. And what happened in that case is that internet users brought a suit against several pharmaceutical companies and PharmaTrack, the provider of an online data aggregation product that was funneling information to the pharmaceutical companies about the users' use of the website and their own inquiries on the site and clickstream and other kinds of data. Fundamentally, the pharmaceutical companies had made PharmaTrack promise them that they wouldn't do anything that didn't comport with the privacy policies of the website, and they protected themselves from liability in that way by making their provider, PharmaTrack, make an affirmative representation that data collection practices will be in line with what users expected. What really happened was PharmaTrack didn't do that. They collected all kinds of additional data and started sharing it. So the users got angry, went after PharmaTrack, went after the pharmaceutical companies. In the lower court, the case was dismissed, and neither the pharmaceutical companies and or Farmer Track was found to have any liability to users and were not found in violation of the electronic, the ECPA, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. However, the appellate court reversed and in fact said that the pharmaceutical companies, because of those affirmative representations in their contracts with the providers, they took adequate care in protecting their users' information. However, PharmaTrack didn't do that, breached their contract, did bad acts, and was on the hook to the consumers. So that case has been remanded, pending further for the decision from the district court. And so this is a very clear-cut example where your contract can be used as an affirmative tool to protect you in litigation when things go wrong and your providers don't perform the way they're supposed to. Okay, derivative works and corollary rights we've touched on. The issue is that all intellectual property should be assigned to you. If there's anything new created, that needs to be given to you as well. And think about if the relationship's going to continue into the future and if you're going to have ongoing new projects that are going to need the services, require the services of these contractors, and whether you want to think about that in this contract, at this initial round of contracting, or whether you want to just leave something that says future development will be agreed to at a later point in time and we'll negotiate it then. And finally, assignment. Is it a particular individual you want to work on your site or your new product, or are you okay with the provider assigning it to Joe's Crab Shack and development company? You know, that's an excellent question. There wasn't a discussion of that from the end of the pharmaceutical companies. However, the court, in fact, imposed almost an affirmative obligation on PharmaTrack to teach the pharmaceutical companies how to conduct their activity on the website to facilitate PharmaTrack not having additional information. Specifically, there was a discussion in the case about get versus post methods. And because of some of the pharmaceutical companies' sites using the get method, they had additional information that really didn't need to be there. And it's a wonderful question because the court affirmatively almost imposed the obligation on the provider to educate the client about how to best protect their users' data. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay, so those are services agreements. The next type of agreement that becomes critical in a broader scheme of information protection within an entity are employment agreements and severance / termination agreements with key employees. So as apart from contractor agreements, these are your ongoing employee relationships. These agreements critically require strong confidentiality provisions, targeting the types of information that the individual employee will have access to. Again, an assignment of inventions and a work-for-hire provision. If in the course of their employment, these individuals are going to have the ability to create new intellectual property, and non-competition, non-solicitation provisions to protect yourself against the relationship going south, or even in the course of their employment, if you people do crazy things. And as I'll talk about later, because trade secret protection varies state by state, your contracts need to holistically approach it with the law of the state and make sure that you protect the maximum amount of information possible. And I'll talk about this later, but different states vary in the length of time that you can have a non-solicitation provision last or non-competition provision, and the geographic scope that you can restrict people's competition. And if you write that provision too broadly, some courts in some states will toss out the entire provision and you are left with no non-competition and no non-solicitation provision at all. So it's critical that you make sure that your lawyers review the particular law of the particular jurisdiction that they're writing the agreement for you in. Some states do something called blue penciling and they'll just fix the provision that is overly broad, but some states won't do that and they simply kick it out. And with that, we move to trade secret law. Trade secret law, as I mentioned, varies state by state in the extent to which it protects employer or other confidential information. Each state has a statute, and the language varies, so you really need to look at it on a state-by-state basis at the trade secret statutes. In a nutshell, trade secret statutes define what constitutes a trade secret. They define it with, in most cases, great precision. And this definition is probably the critical component that varies state by state. For example, I had a client in Wisconsin that had a former employee freely distribute their client list after the employee was no longer in the employ of my client. In Wisconsin, unfortunately, client lists are usually not protectable information, even if they harbor great value. Under Illinois law, however, they usually are protectable information. So how you can strategize in this situation is to not always default to the law of the jurisdiction that you're sitting in or you're incorporated in. Nothing says that you have to have your contract be governed by the law of the state you're sitting in. There's a state that has better law. Just have your contract specify, we want this contract to be construed in accordance with the law of the state of Illinois. And therefore, you buy yourself a choice of law and a legal regime that will implement your contractual relationship in a light that's more positive for you. Mm-hmm. Sure. That's absolutely correct. It varies on a state-by-state basis to the extent that you can choose to opt out of a particular state's law. A court can find that it's against public policy of the particular state to have an employee sign on to an agreement that's governed by a different state's law. Some courts will say that an employee of a certain level of sophistication can, in fact, alienate that right to the protection of the laws of that state. California is an extreme example. In most states, you can pick your choice of law relatively freely, especially if you're dealing with a CFO or a CTO or someone on a very high level of compensation and experience and sophistication. Courts will generally find that the parties are of relatively equal bargaining position and can agree to a choice of law that's different from one that might be the normal, the usual default in a situation of contracting within a particular jurisdiction. After that, after the incident of the client list, my client never contracted under Wisconsin law in an employment agreement again. They switched to Illinois law, for example. So in Wisconsin, Illinois, the choice of law regimes are far more liberal than the state of California, which is a very employee-friendly state. And a very important point to be aware of because it all varies jurisdiction by jurisdiction. The second component of trade secret protection is the question of adequate security conditions within the enterprise and whether the statute extends to the security conditions that were in place. What do I mean? Was the proprietary information kept sufficiently secret? Did you have locks on the file cabinets? Did you have non-disclosure agreements in place? Did you release the information only on a need-to-know basis? Or were people able to access everyone's proprietary information with a click of a mouse? Were there no technological or physical limitations to access of individuals to information? And were these efforts reasonable under the circumstances? And the term reasonable is sort of a favorite lawyer term that drives everyone else in the world nuts, because reasonable can be anything a court wants it to be within a certain realm of possibilities. Ultimately, a reasonability standard says, would the average person in this situation take this level of care or a greater level of care to protect the information that is being alleged to fall within the purview of the trade secret statute? So, Would a reasonable person have locks on the file cabinets if it's really sensitive information? Yes, most likely a reasonable person would. Would a reasonable person have password protections on databases that deal with financial information? Yes, a reasonable person would. And there are also other obligations in the case of financial information, which we'll talk about later. Fundamentally, the critical component is a consistent information protection program throughout an enterprise. If there is really great information protection in one part of your enterprise and a different part has pretty weak information protection, even if the leakage occurs in the part with the great information protection, opposing counsel and the court will look to the weakest link within your scheme of information protection. You need to have a non-disclosure agreement with every single employee, with every single contractor, with anyone who comes in contact with your data. If there's one employee that has unlimited access to data unfettered, and another employee has severe restrictions, and even if it's the severely restricted employee that causes the release, they're going to point to the employee that had unfettered access and say, hey, this person had access to way more than they needed. You're not taking due care. You're not acting in accordance with a prudent approach to information protection, and so we can't extend the protection of the statute to you. And one main way that entities do this is through their employee handbooks. Employee handbooks are a very important tool to show the world, hey, as an entity, we have this policy of information protection. So your employee handbooks should have blanket policy on the approach to privacy that you take as an enterprise, what your clients expect, what you expect of your employees, what your contractors are expected to do, really setting forth this whole grand scheme of information protection. Sure. Ultimately, I'm going to say more is better. The more you articulate in one particular place, the stronger your program appears to an uneducated judge who may be looking at this. Highlighting the most important elements of non-disclosure agreements with every employee, of everyone having access on a need-to-know-only basis, of particular data retention or destruction policies, an electronic communications policy that limits the ability of employees to view pornography, for example, from their work computers, and that also informs employees that they have no privacy in their electronic communications or their particular company-issued computers. Absolutely. It extends to every digital device. Employees forget this on a regular basis. And in certain contexts, for example, with child pornography, as an employer, you may have an affirmative obligation to ferret out the source of any contact with child pornography within your organization. So it's critical that you put your employees on notice and you have an aggressive, holistic plan in place to deal with these kinds of issues. Good question. The extent of your contractual protections, for example, with the cleaning staff. You probably don't need to make the cleaning staff say that they're going to hand over every new invention that they create. Probably not that critical to have those inventions. But the high-end people, you want those inventions, and specifying the kinds of information that particular individuals are going to have access to is good, but you want to leave it as broad as possible, because even though you may not need an assignment of inventions from your cleaning staff, in the course of their duties, who knows what they'll have access to. They may find the random scrap of paper that the CFO printed out and threw in his or her garbage can. And so as a consequence of that, which was in the course of their duties and not a particular act that they affirmatively sought to dig out this information, they're going to see stuff that you probably don't want to be public knowledge. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely could be. If you're not taking care in the disposal of your data, which a lot of entities aren't, that could definitely be the weak link. Excellent question. The question was, frequently you're in a situation where someone won't show you their new product or new, whatever proprietary information they have without requiring that you execute a non-disclosure agreement. And what if, for example, you have independently developed a similar invention that may, in the mind of the disclosing person, overlap significantly and infringe on their rights? The answer is you have to negotiate the non-disclosure agreement and make sure that there is a standard provision that if you have independently derived this information, the information was in your possession previously, you obtain the information as a consequence of public disclosure or through any other means that does not impinge on the rights of the disclosing entity, and you can prove it, then that's ultimately the key. If you can prove this, then they have no cause of action against you and it doesn't constitute a violation of the non-disclosure agreement.
Mm-hmm. I've been to his lab with me, and I signed on this rule. We always say rules, but one of the rules is I can't disclose the fact that I even have it.
Okay.
It's very common. Mm-hmm. Now I come over next door to Microsoft and told the same product, okay? Signed the agreement, but now they got the same intellectual property, the true intellectual property of this corporation that the other side has, and now I am really stuck in there.
Mm-hmm. So the key is to make sure that the agreements are all written in a way that let you function in that middle position. So in other words, you're saying if you have knowledge that two individuals have similar intellectual property and you independently have that intellectual property that you've developed as well. If both of those agreements have the carve-out, that independent information that you derived through means other than your access to the information that's provided by the disclosing individuals, as long as that carve-out exists, you're okay. As long as you can demonstrate that, in fact, you're having the information, deriving the information, predated your relationship with the two entities in question. So it's all about the minutiae of the non-disclosure agreement. So the moral of the story is write them as broadly as possible if you're trying to protect yourself, and negotiate them down as much as you can if you're the person receiving the information, because it really does matter, and each non-disclosure agreement is different, and there are standard carve-outs that can create a more fair arrangement for both parties. Okay. So, on we go. As I said, a prerequisite for obtaining trade secret information, confidentiality agreements across the board, and physical security, like the locks on the lab cabinets. Okay. Physical security, I'll just touch on that a little more before I launch off into intellectual property law. In my experience with clients, and also being around law firms, I'm going to use law firms as an example of people who chronically sometimes, despite their heightened concern for confidentiality and their fiduciary obligations to their clients, sometimes don't always act with optimal care in the way that information is handled. From what I've seen in my clients and their own law firms, there are sort of three types of people. There are random embracers of technology who just accept any new technological invention that comes down the pike, whether they think through how it's going to impact information secrecy practices or not. And there are cautious progressives who slowly move into new modes of data transfer, contemplating how the process will continue and impact their confidentiality obligations. And then there are blue-dye technophobes who, in the case of one person that I worked with, check their email on their knees with one finger. And so the optimal people to be doing your technology planning are the middle people who will be concerned with things like encryption and not just expediting information flows. Within an organization, there are a lot of non-obvious points for physical leakage of information. One law firm that I worked with, they had someone in the mailroom conducting trades on the basis of insider securities information. He would send occasional faxes, make a little note to self, merger going down, two publicly traded companies, let's make some bucks. Information leakage, a real problem, and the law firm had a very embarrassing situation on their hands because of that. Document management systems, which are prevalent through law firms and probably other organizations as well, can give a lot of access to a lot of confidential information with minimal effort to anyone who has access to the system. Support staff, people on all levels of the enterprise. Spam filters are something that people are not embracing as widely as they should. For example, one law firm that I know of, it's gotten to the point where they have over 60% of their incoming email is spam. They have no filters on, and nobody has changed any of their passwords in at least 2.5 years, to my knowledge. Okay, disaster waiting to happen. But people just aren't on top of the little things that can really show that you have taken due care if something bad does happen to you. And I mean, if I were looking to hang liability, those are the kind of things that I would look for and point out to say, hey, these people clearly not taking information security seriously. Okay, and with that, we go on to intellectual property law. I don't know did everyone hear that? Could you repeat that loudly? That's an excellent question. Did everyone hear? The question was, what happens if a breach occurs in the middle of a rollout of a new security program that's entity-wide? The bottom line is that a court would look at that if the entity in the middle of the rollout could demonstrate, hey, we have approached this seriously. We're in the middle of a rollout. We are really trying to fix this. It was in the process of our attempts. We're on top of it. The bottom line is that in the phase of assessment of liability, undoubtedly a court would view that favorably and say, these aren't people who are blowing off their security obligations. They were working on it, merely the timing was bad, and so undoubtedly liability would be mitigated by that factor. So it would be viewed positively. A concrete result will vary situation, of course, but undoubtedly that would be viewed as a positive factor. Mm-hmm. That's a valid point, and undoubtedly that's something that would make the positive effect diminished slightly and it also would depend on the reason the rollout took longer. If the reason the rollout took longer was that new security flaws were discovered and needed to be addressed in order to comprehensively handle the potential points of leakage. That's a positive reason the rollout would take longer. If the rollout took longer because nobody was on top of getting back all of the confidentiality agreements from all the employees and people slacked off in the process of implementing the rollout, then that would be viewed negatively. So I think it would depend on why it took longer. But that could be a negative factor and an otherwise positive mitigating factor. You're saying in the context of, for example, confidentiality agreements, to make sure that it's protected information? The question is, what about information that's derived from confidential information? What do you do with that? You have employees that are generating second round spreadsheets and working through calculations, et cetera. The bottom line is that hopefully your non-disclosure agreements are written in such a way that that is contemplated as confidential information. It generally is. Your non-disclosure agreements with your employees should say, the following items are considered confidential information, and any and all items derived therefrom in any and all media. So you immediately sweep within that framework the spreadsheets, the extra information that was created for the PowerPoint created for the presentation of the board of directors, and email that you sent, you know, hey, how about lunch? By the way, I noticed on the spreadsheet that XYZ was present and that's a trend. So by drafting that provision very broadly, you can encapsulate the information that's also derived from confidential information. Excellent point. And that falls within the question of the employee handbooks and education procedures in place to really make your employees aware of the broader security and privacy initiatives that are going on within the entity. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see. The answer I'm going to give you is the horrific lawyer answer that everyone hates. It depends. In the situation of a merger, it depends how the assignment provision in each of the contracts is written. Some assignment provisions specifically carve out the situation of a change of control, including a merger, an asset sale, things like that. Some assignment provisions don't include that. So it depends on what the particular provision says. In the case of a bankruptcy, that asset is still the property of the entity that's in bankruptcy to be disposed of by the bankruptcy court. Now, if there's still outstanding payments and services have entirely been performed, then that's usually going to get set aside by the bankruptcy court and you're generally out of luck. But if there's an ongoing relationship with services still being performed, you may have some recourse and they have higher priority as a creditor of that entity. It depends what the court does with your particular contract, realistically. But on a general level, that design, whether it's been produced or not, is included in the bankruptcy estate of the entity. Okay. Any other? Yes. Thank you. excellent point. The question was, what happens if you want to renegotiate the terms of an employment agreement or a non-disclosure agreement? And unfortunately, generic lawyer answer, it depends. In this case, it depends on the state that you're sitting in. Some states require that any changes or additional agreements be followed, or along with them, additional consideration to the employee happens. You give the employee meaningful compensation in some way, whether it's 2 days off for it or $200. Some states require that if you don't give something extra, then you don't really have a right to additional promises from the employee. So it really varies state by state. In some states, you can make changes to the employment relationship conditioned solely on continued employment. So it really matters on the particular labor law regime of the state that you're sitting in. Physical assets they reside. Do you mean, can you give me a kind of? In that instance, it's the intellectual property that resides on the server. Okay. I'm going to briefly continue on into privacy regulation because this is probably perhaps the most valuable tidbits of information that I can convey to you. And if there are any additional questions on the sort of front-end contracting stuff, I'd be happy to talk about it on the break. Okay, affirmative privacy obligations, the second half, the sword that you're trying to protect yourself against using, the shield of the contracts that I was just describing. There are three possible sources of privacy obligations. And I've sort of skipped over copyright. It's in my outline, and I'd be happy to answer any additional questions about it. And please feel free to email me as well. Basically, just the foundations of federal intellectual property protection and criminal computer intrusion law, something to be aware of, stiff penalties. In some instances, for example, the DMCA, penalties for a second offense can get as high as $1 million and 10 years in prison. So. Criminal penalties can be severe. Sources of legal privacy obligations. Three sources of legal privacy obligations. Legally imposed, meaning by statute. Self-imposed, meaning privacy policies and promises that you make to your clients. And industry imposed, which is the standard of negligence, which is a constantly changing and evolving mechanism through which courts expect individuals and entities to exercise reasonable care in the way that they treat information and services. Okay, first. Legally imposed privacy obligations. In general, there are three types of data from a U.S.-centric perspective when it comes to information that you have access to and collect from your clients. The first category is sensitive data. Sensitive data in the U.S. refers to children's data, financial data, health data, and foreign data. And I'm going to talk about each one of these in turn. Children's data, there's the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which requires affirmative parental consent for collection of information from children 13 and under. What does verified parental consent mean? The statute, as it was written, contemplated something like an exchange of faxes. Currently, they've extended the ability of entities to obtain verified parental consent through email. However, on top of that, you need a second form, and that email option is going to be phased out progressively. So if you are dealing with any online transmissions of children's data, and if you think that even if children may be using your site, you need to be careful with this act because it's being aggressively enforced by the Federal Trade Commission. Recently, there were two high-profile prosecutions against Hershey's and Mrs. Fields, both resulting in relatively serious liability. Mrs. Fields faced a fine of $100,000 under the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, and Hershey's faced a fine of $85,000. And they both entered into a consent decree with the Federal Trade Commission, which means that they're basically going to be monitored very carefully and placed under higher levels of scrutiny than they had been previously. The second category of information is financial information. Financial information falls under the purview of the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which states that financial institutions are required to exercise due care in the way that they handle consumer information. Online, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act requires that the graphical user interfaces of certain websites of financial institutions, and sort of footnote, the statute defines the term financial institutions very broadly. So we're not talking about strictly banks here. We're talking about banks, any provider of services to a bank, any institution, individual that has access to the types of financial information that is spelled out in the statute. So it's a murky statute and gives itself a lot of flexibility in who it can go after under that statute. So the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act requires that the graphical user interfaces of websites post a privacy policy prominently and in a particular place on the graphical user interface. Specifically, it says in relation to the name of the bank, and it has to be in a certain size font and a certain appearance. So they're getting a little draconian in the way that they're setting forth these standards. I'm sorry? It can. It depends on the particular industry and the particular data transmissions. For example, does the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act inherently encompass any credit card transaction? The short answer is, again, going to be it depends. If you're the entity that's providing the credit card services to other entities, you can be classified as a financial institution because you are sort of primarily trafficking in financial information of users. So it depends on the particular business purpose and the way that you're carrying out the transactions. But it's something to be watchful about, in particular, since they're not done regulating through Gramm-Leach-Bliley yet. They're explaining it through further rulings. And the thing that's sort of scary from a client standpoint about this statute is that there's something like 11 different agencies that are empowered to prosecute people under this statute, including state attorneys general, Federal Trade Commission, bank regulators, you name it, they can prosecute you under this statute. So it's a very aggressive stance on financial privacy. And in particular, sure. I agree with the caveat that if, for example, you're PayPal, I think you're covered. So it depends on the way that you're carrying out the transactions. But I couldn't agree more. If you're just doing mom and pop little sales with occasional credit card charges and in lieu of checks or cash transactions or whatever it may be, most likely you don't fall under the purview of Gramm-Leach-Bliley. But my advice would be err on the side of caution because there are very powerful enforcement mechanisms for this statute. Yes. Gramm-Leach-Bliley, something else that it requires, and this is something that I've seen my former banking clients kind of miss. Gramm-Leach-Bliley requires that your provider agreements contain magic language that imposes on all of your providers the privacy obligations that you are subject to. So outside of mandating a disseminated privacy policy to your consumers, it really requires that as an entity that falls under the purview of Gramm-Leach-Bliley, you take affirmative steps with anyone who comes in contact with the information that's collected from your consumers. The other point on privacy policies in general, but it particularly plays in with Gramm-Leach-Bliley, is that the Federal Trade Commission has recently taken a somewhat aggressive position that there is no more dichotomy between online privacy policies and offline privacy policies. Everything has to comport. So that means that as a practical matter, entities really need to have good communications between their web people and their offline people and the way that they handle, receive, store information, because it's all one enterprise from the standpoint of prosecution and the Federal Trade Commission. The next category of data is health data. The Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, like Gramm-Leach-Bliley, imposes a higher standard of care on entities that that deal with health-related data. And again, it's a statute that covers a broad range of entities, everything from universities that can conduct clinical trials with patients in their hospitals, for example, to insurance providers, clearly, or other entities that have access to health information as a consequence of their relationship with insurance providers. Sorry? Right. The next category of sensitive information is foreign data. Specifically, Canada, the European Union, for example, have a higher standard of care that they choose to have in place with their citizens' data. The European Union, in particular, has taken an aggressive stance. There's a data directive in place that was passed in 1996, implemented in, I believe, in 1999, early 1999, late 1998, that really is just a completely different framework on data protection from that which exists within the United States. And so people got very concerned about that, and they negotiated a safe harbor agreement that is on the Department of Commerce website, if you'd like to read it in greater detail. And so far, about 350, more or less, entities have decided to apply for a status of certification under this safe harbor agreement. As a practical matter, the safe harbor agreement, it helps, but it may not be a very potent method of protection for your entities because, among other things, it doesn't take into account the elimination of that dichotomy that I was just talking about that the Federal Trade Commission eliminated. The safe harbor agreement lets you specify, is it dealing with online data or is it dealing with offline data? And if that difference doesn't exist anymore, then part of what you're declaring in order to receive your certification under the safe harbor is no longer as applicable. So the entire question of the potency of the safe harbor is still up in the air a little bit. And what's happening is that you see companies like Microsoft dealing with the EU in independent terms, even though Microsoft is a signatory to the safe harbor agreement and has been certified. They ended up dealing with the European Union Data Directive Commission independently and have cut a deal with them apart from the safe harbor. So the major players may be cutting their own relationships anyway, and so the strength of the safe harbor is in question. But be aware of foreign data that's coming in, and it should be held to a higher standard of care. The second category of data is U.S. personally identifiable data and non-personally identifiable data. With regard to that type of data, the issue is just to follow through on privacy policies that are promulgated and they're circulated to consumers. If consumers expect that their data isn't going to be shared because of the statements that are made in a privacy policy, then that's what the privacy practices need to be. A privacy policy is a contract. If you breach a contract, you're going to have consequences, and so that's what a privacy policy is. Basically, it's a contract between the users and the entity making the promises that in exchange for receiving the data, certain standards of care are going to be used with it. And again, the Federal Trade Commission has been very aggressive in prosecuting websites that breach their privacy policies don't use data in accordance with the promises that they've made to consumers. A wonderful example of this in the category of self-imposed protection is the Eli Lilly consent decree case. In that instance, the pharmaceutical company had a website that permitted users to sign up for reminders about their Prozac intake. And what happened, human error, they had promised that an automated system would anonymously send these reminders to the Prozac users, except the automated system turned out to be some person dropping a list of email addresses into the BCC field of an email. Well, the person's hand slipped one day, and the email addresses all got dropped in the CC field. So everyone on the list saw everyone else's email. Prozac may have social stigma associated with it, and so therefore Federal Trade Commission stepped in and said, look, you promised these people their information would be confidential. People could have been harmed reputationally, et cetera, in this instance. Consent decree, we're keeping an eye on you for a really long time now, and watch what you're doing with people's information. They made a privacy promise, didn't keep it, that got in trouble. And the FTC is increasingly getting aggressive in the way that they're handling these promises. Even in bankruptcy, your privacy obligations hold. There was a case dealing with a toy manufacturer that went out of business. They tried to sell their database of consumer information as one of the bankruptcy assets. Bankruptcy court said, too bad, you promised these users their information would be kept confidential, and that's what your obligation is, even in bankruptcy. Okay. And finally, as I am running out of time, yes? You're doing a great job. Go ahead. I can say from experiences with my clients and the things that they've experienced that theft of information in banks is a day-to-day occurrence. In particular, disgruntled employees in banks walk away with enormous amounts of personally identifiable financial information. And short of an affirmative obligation to disclose that, which until things like this act really hasn't existed but for privacy promises that banks have made in their own statements of how they'll treat information. Your, my information can be circulating willy-nilly and we will never know because there's no affirmative obligation to disclose this until some sort of regulation like legislation that we've been discussing comes into place. Right. I mean, ultimately, the way that conservative attorneys advise their clients in those situations is to think about what the potential cost is to disclosure versus non-disclosure. And usually if you can quantify the extent of the potential losses on an individual basis based on, for example, how much money the people have in the accounts, et cetera, and that number ends up being not that egregious and you're willing as an entity to absorb those costs, and then they might hit you down the road in some sort of litigation or in a settlement, then your PR will usually end up being of greater value to you in the short term, and no disclosures will be made. Not the most positive practice from the standpoint of those of us who've been victims of identity theft at some point, but nevertheless, the way the cold, harsh reality of data control works. Yeah. Right. And on the final note of data privacy, specifically with regard to court judgments and how court judgments evolve and cause entities to rethink the way that they approach their privacy practices. And this is where I see the law going. This isn't really in place yet, and it's going to be a long road to get this body of case law in place. But this is where I think the future is. Imposing a duty of due care through a negligence standard, what a reasonable level of care is, the amorphous concept of what would a reasonable person in this instance do. And those standards of reasonability are going to, at the end of the day, vary based on industry. And perhaps on the resources of the individuals involved. There's a famous case in this area that has nothing to do with data privacy or technology, but it dealt with tugboats. It's a very old case. And there was a tugboat that got into trouble and damage resulted. And the bottom line was that the tugboat didn't have a radio and couldn't call into the shore to be advised of the potential damage that would result if they continued chugging along in the waterway. And the court said that at that point in time, the tugboat industry had established this business norm of having radios in tugboats. So what this means for the future is that if, as, say, an ASP of educational services, if your fellow industry members evolve to a certain standard of care in encryption, in data handling, in data sharing, data elimination, then ultimately you'll be held to that same standard of care whether or not you're making the affirmative promise to your users in your contracts, because that is simply what is reasonable in the situation. As a social policy matter, that's where the courts and society want your care to be. So violations of industry norms are going to result ultimately in judgments of negligence against the entities that don't comport with reasonability in the way that they handle data. So the inquiry, as I said, is whether the level of care exercised in a particular circumstance falls below the level of care that a reasonable person or entity would have exercised in the same circumstances. So in conclusion, how to mitigate risk. I have four suggestions on sort of a meta level of industry-wide data practices and contractual practices. View your contract as a historical record of your transactions. A contract doesn't have to be just papering a transaction and getting it done and out the door and appeasing legal in having some sort of memorialization of what's going to happen. But if you view your contracts as really explaining the obligations of the parties and potentially acting as a protective mechanism in the case of litigation, and thinking about how to really spell out in great detail the relationship and the results of what you want the relationship to develop into, this historical record can be a powerful mechanism both to enforce your rights under the agreement and to protect yourself against potential suit for against an allegation of breach of your obligations under that agreement. Secondly, make your contracts very specific, falling in line with the previous point. Specify encryption standards, specify the care of data that you want to be exercised in the course of the relationship. Always question. There was one client that I had that it was a partnership between a major brokerage house and my client, and they were transmitting financial data, basically instant relays of CBOE trade information. There were no encryption standards specified in the agreement. That's really bad. Someone could have easily gotten into that, those transmissions. At the end of the day, I started asking questions, and I found out that the tech staff of the major brokerage house had thought this through somewhat and had orally gotten an agreement that the transmissions would be in image format. Okay, a little better. But it didn't say that in the contract. So if the provider had chosen not to transmit the data in an image format, that would have been a very vulnerable situation. Would liability have potentially accrued to my client? I think so, because that kind of information is not something that one would expect reasonably, you know, would be easy access to a 15-year-old in a basement. And one good hack could shut down the Chicago Board of Options Exchange with no problem, I have no doubt. And that's a very bad thing. And it's through contractual specificities that we can keep our mechanisms of society running in that way. Anyway, but I'll get off my high horse. Think as far ahead as possible and in terms of what can go wrong. Planning ahead for the worst case scenario isn't necessarily a cynical doomsday outlook, but it's also preemptive thinking that can make the relationship actually work more smoothly and turn into a more positive relationship down the road. Talking through potential problems and putting it down in writing will, at the end of the day, potentially insulate both sides from liability, eliminate misunderstanding, and assist in compliance with privacy regulation. Working through potential problems on the front end is always, always cheaper than ending up in litigation later. Litigators are very expensive. Another 15 minutes of your transactional attorney's time will save you hundreds of dollars in many hours of litigators' expenses later. And finally, instituting good entity-wide data control and security practices is the A number one mechanism for ensuring trade secret protection, for limiting breaches, and for building confidence in your entities and in your entities' data practices, both internally and externally. Have a policy in place with developed checks and balances, with procedures for reporting data leakages, circulate your employee handbooks, make your employees sign off on your employee handbooks. Non-disclosure agreements should be in place across the entity and with independent contractors. Perform background checks on your employees and contractors. Look for the big red flags of potential breaches. And as required by HIPAA, move toward having a chief privacy officer in place and someone who really focuses on protecting your entity against liability for privacy breaches and planning preemptive steps to develop a course for your entity down the road to develop into a strong entity that both protects privacy and maximizes the ability to leverage data that's collected. Any questions? Then that's it. Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah.